From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The latest immigration reform proposals stress border security, but abuses can occur.
Going up to people and asking for documents for no reason at all is a problem.
We'll speak with the author of a new report examining the U.S. Border Patrol. And the last time immigration reform passed Congress, its main champion was a Republican president.
Congress is back at it to get an immigration bill that will give us once again control of our borders.
Ronald Reagan and the 1986 immigration reform. And finally, Los Tigres del Norte make music about immigrants' rights. Now, a new generation takes up their freedom songs.
I mean, I think it's important to remember where we came from.
Raúl y Mexaya. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. For the news this week, we've invited Victor Landa, editor of the website News Taco, back on the show to fill us in on some of what's abuzz. He joins us now from the studios of KSTX in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome back to Latino USA, Victor.
Hello, Maria. Pleasure to be with you.
All right, let's start with not such a pleasant topic. This one has to do with Senator Bob Menendez. So the day after we see him as one of the so-called Gang of Eight senators presenting a proposal for comprehensive immigration reform, news hits about a series of allegations that include influence peddling and involvement with underage prostitutes in the Dominican Republic. What do we know for certain so far regarding Senator Bob Menendez?
For certain, we know that there was an FBI investigation into one of his major donors. He's calling all of these allegations smears. And like you said, it stems from these what he calls anonymous people from a website, but still.
So how do you think that this will affect the issue of his position with immigration reform, where he's getting also a lot of attention?
You know, he's been a member of the Senate Banking and Finance and Foreign Relations Committees, and he's chairing an important subcommittee that'll be very important in the coming debate on taxes and, of course, everything that he's doing now with immigration. I don't think that these allegations, as long as they're allegations, are going to hurt him and his rising star. Now, if they do turn into something else, well, then we're talking about a completely different set of circumstances.
All right, well, talk about slow. This week, there have been reports that another congressional committee, this time from the House, is about to release its own proposal for immigration reform, possibly around the time President Obama delivers the State of the Union on February 12th. Is the House committee proposal thought to contain anything different from what we've seen from the Senate and from the president?
It was put forth by Illinois Congressman Luis Gutierrez and also on border California's Javier Becerra, Idaho's Raul Obrador, and Mario Diaz-Balart from Florida. Now, what's in it? Who knows? But for the sake of expediency, which seems to be what everybody wants now, it would be best if it mirrored the Senate plan so that similar plans were initiated in each chamber and they met somewhere in the middle. But yeah, before you couldn't get a plan if you begged for one, and now it seems that you can juggle them. So it's really interesting to see that all of a sudden we've got all of these plans where before there was nothing, and to find out that they've been meeting for years, and suddenly they come out and they say, we've got a plan, we're not going to tell you what it is, we're just going to tell you that we're going to have it, we're going to tell you something before the State of the Union. And there it is.
All right. Well, staying on the immigration topic for a moment here, we noticed that a new Pew Hispanic Center study says that nearly two-thirds of Mexican-born immigrants in the United States who are here legally have not applied for citizenship. In fact, their rate of naturalization is only about half of the average for immigrants from other countries. So what's going on with Mexicans who have green cards not following through and becoming citizens?
36% of eligible Mexican nationals become citizens, and that's less than other Latin American or Caribbean nations. And you know, there could be several factors. We always talk about the proximity of Mexico. That's always mentioned. You know, that the homeland being so close that many Mexicans truly see their time in the U.S. as temporary. And also, many Mexican nationals don't know that they can have dual citizenship. Mexico permits it since 1998, I believe. And the Pew study did show that 26% said that language was a barrier to citizenship. And then money and administrative barriers was cited by another 18%. And that's something that's really big, because the application cost for citizenship is $680. The Pew comes out with this very interesting study while we're talking about immigration.
Now, something to end that's a little bit surprising, or perhaps not. We hear that journalist Geraldo Rivera is, in fact, considering throwing his hat into the ring for a Senate seat, running for the seat currently held by Democrat Frank Lautenberg in New Jersey. What do you think Geraldo Rivera is doing here?
I think the quote was that he's truly contemplating, and you can parse that in many ways. What he says, I think, is that he's being seriously coy about it. See, he's a Republican, right? He's a Latino. He's a known personality. The question is he serious? And will the voters of New Jersey vote for him and take him seriously? Until now, no Republican has announced a run for that post. So far, it's his on the GOP side if he wants it. But, you know, there's a long time between now and 2014 when this election is going to take place. And there's a lot of space between seriously contemplating and I'm definitely running. So is he serious or not? We're going to find out. And I'm sure that we're going to be talking about this thing again.
Thanks for joining us again, Victor.
Thank you, Maria.
Victor Landa is the editor for the website News Taco. He joined us from the studios of KSTX in San Antonio, Texas. And for more information, check out our website at latinousa.org or follow us on Twitter, where we are LatinoUSA, all one word. And we're back in 30 segundos, 30 seconds. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Most people in the U.S. agree on the need for vigilance in securing the country's borders, but often that vigilance is too aggressive. A new report reveals surprising information about some internal practices within the U.S. Border Patrol. Nancy Moravetz is a professor of clinical law at New York University School of Law and is co-author of the report. She joins us to talk about the findings from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome to Latino USA, Nancy.
Thank you very much for having me.
So your report covers information about arrests that were made by the U.S. Border Patrol between 2006 and 2010. What did you find out about the practices of the Border Patrol?
Well, we looked at the arrests that the Border Patrol was making on trains and buses, and almost none of the people being arrested were people who had recently entered the country. This report looks at the people with lawful status who wind up getting arrested, taken down to a Border Patrol station, and held for several hours, often in the middle of the night, even though they are U.S. citizens, permanent residents, asylees, or other kinds of people with legal status.
All right, well, let's bring it back a minute. So these are people who are traveling on buses or trains in New York State, happen to be close to the Canadian border, within a 100-mile radius. You're saying that it's been a consistent practice since 2006 for Border Patrol agents to get on trains and buses and start asking people for their IDs?
Yes. And this was for people who were traveling domestically. So our main concern is with what the Border Patrol is doing when people are just traveling within the United States or doing other things within the United States.
I'm trying to understand, is there a problem with Border Patrol agents kind of asking people on buses and trains to produce ID? Is that legal, legitimate? Is that okay?
Well, they're not asking for ID, and in any event, I think going up to people and asking for documents for no reason at all is a problem. I mean, it means we live in a society in which we're all expected to carry documents at all time. And our report includes people who are United States citizens who would show a driver's license, but the Border Patrol officer just wouldn't believe that the person was a U.S. citizen, so they would bring them in, make them get off the train, get off the bus, go down to the Border Patrol station until they were satisfied that the person was a citizen or a permanent resident. But when the Border Patrol gets on a train or a bus, they are carrying guns, they're leaning over, and they're asking people questions. People do not feel free to just not answer those questions. And yet the Border Patrol claims that this entire process that they engage in is consensual.
And you believe then that people are in fact being wrongfully arrested. Is that correct?
Yes. I think that people are being wrongfully arrested. The Border Patrol is expecting documents that they don't have any right to expect. And that even where there's an argument about whether they have a right to expect the documents, we have to ask ourselves what kind of a country we want to live in. In our report, for example, we describe tourists who've just arrived in the United States. They're traveling to see Chicago, and they're getting hauled off a train because they're not carrying their passport on them. And yet when an American travels abroad, our State Department says, your passport's a precious document. Keep it in a safe in a hotel. Don't carry it on your person at all times. And yet the Border Patrol treats this as something everybody has to do all the time.
Now, there is also something that you uncover in your report. The agents were getting incentives, were getting rewards, depending on the number of people who they arrested?
What we uncovered is that there are clear cash reward programs and gift card programs and time off programs that are used to reward officers. We also found clear evidence that despite years of denying it, the only metric that these offices would look at is how many people were being arrested and that there are bonus programs. We do not make a claim that we know for sure that the bonuses were being given based on arrests, but in a culture that's based on arrests, these kinds of bonus programs are very dangerous. They're very dangerous unless there's very careful oversight, and we found no evidence of that oversight.
So basically, you're saying that the bonuses, the carrot, could lead to Border Patrol agents arresting people unnecessarily.
Yes. You know, if they think there's some question, they'll say, oh, okay, let me just arrest this person. And then, well, if it turns out to be a permanent resident or somebody on a work visa or a student visa, I'll just return them to the station and there's no real problem there. But it is a problem. For the person who was traveling, it's a big problem. If you have a culture that is looking at arrest rates, then you can expect that you will have the kind of human consequences we document in our report.
And what are the human consequences?
Well, in one case, for example, there was a student who had a student visa, a student from Jamaica in New York City who had been traveling, and she was on her way home. It was midnight, and she got pulled off the bus, got taken down to the Border Patrol station, was held there for several hours until her status was verified. Then she was taken back to the bus station at 3 in the morning to wait for the next bus at 4:45 in the morning. You know, I would not want to see my child left at a bus station at 3 in the morning having been pulled off the bus.
So what do you think needs to happen in order to have a Border Patrol that is doing its job, but that is also respecting basic civil and constitutional rights of American citizens and people with green cards and even people who don't have documents?
Well, I think the main thing is that in the national debates, the focus shouldn't be on labels like border enforcement or the idea that boots on the ground mean more security at the border. The focus should be on what is Border Patrol actually doing with its resources.
So what would be your top line message to members of the Senate who have proposed this immigration reform, saying anything in terms of any immigration reform path to citizenship is only going to happen contingent on security at the borders?
I would say look at what is actually being done at the border and look at whether the resources you are putting into the border have anything to do with the border or whether they instead lead to the harassment of people who live in those communities and people who travel in those communities and what it means for us as a nation. I mean, one of the cases in our report is a researcher from Sloan Kettering in New York, a very prestigious place, who was pulled off a train. Does that really help the United States move forward in the way that it wants to move forward?
Thanks so much for speaking with us, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Nancy Moravetz is a professor of clinical law at New York University School of Law. She's co-author of the report Uncovering USBP. The report was produced by Families for Freedom and the New York University School of Law Immigrant Rights Clinic. She spoke to us from the NPR studios in New York. Critics of the path to citizenship provisions of the current immigration reform plans say it'll cost American taxpayers millions of dollars to legalize the 11 million undocumented who are currently here. They say a path to citizenship is just another name for amnesty. But is amnesty even the right word to use? Being in the U.S. without papers is an administrative violation in the civil, not criminal realm. Reporter Adrian Florido from Fronteras, the Changing America desk, takes a look at what happened after the reforms of 1986, when so-called amnesty was front and center.
It was 1984, and Congress had just killed an immigration reform bill that would have legalized up to 6 million unauthorized immigrants living in the U.S. The bill's most prominent backer wasn't too happy.
I supported this bill. I believe in the idea of amnesty for those who have put down roots and who have lived here, even though sometime back they may have entered illegally.
But President Reagan wasn't about to back down.
I'm going to do everything I can, and all of us in the administration are, to join in again when Congress is back at it to get an immigration bill that will give us once again control of our borders.
That last part about gaining control of our borders, that was key because the Immigration Reform and Control Act was supposed to solve the nation's immigration problems by doing three things.
It was often referred to as a three-legged stool: border enforcement, workplace enforcement, amnesty.
That's Peter Nunez, who prosecuted lots of immigration cases as the U.S. attorney in San Diego at the time. Today, he's on the board of the Center for Immigration Studies, which supports immigration restrictions. The amnesty bill finally passed in 1986, and it included those provisions for border enforcement and penalties for employers who hired unauthorized workers.
And the idea was that if you just granted an amnesty, that would do nothing more than but to encourage additional future illegal immigration. And that's exactly what happened, because the two enforcement provisions never materialized.
After 86, border security barely improved. Employer penalties weren't enforced. And by 1989, close to 2 million people were crossing the border illegally each year. Now, 26 years later, those statistics are coming back to haunt proponents of a second amnesty for 11 million undocumented immigrants. Like losing coaches studying the post-game video, they're looking back on the 86 bill to figure out what went wrong. Conservatives like Nunez offer a helping hand, arguing that illegal immigration soared because the amnesty encouraged it, and that the same will happen this time.
All you need to do is look at the lessons we have taught. Come here, and sooner or later, we'll let you stay.
Of course, this is 2013. A lot's happened in a quarter century.
Okay, people love to beat up on 1986.
Dimitri Papadimitriou advised lawmakers on the 86 bill and now directs the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute.
Things have changed dramatically. We have invested extraordinary resources in gaining control of the border and in trying to do interior enforcement, which is equally difficult.
Today, hundreds of miles of fence and thousands more agents line the border. The Obama administration has deported more people and fined more employers than any of its predecessors. It has taken a long time.
Is this a failure of 1986? I don't think so. 1986 provided the legal requirements that allowed for these things to evolve.
What he means is that without the 1986 law, we wouldn't even think of immigration reform the way we do today. Back then, building up the border seemed a gargantuan task. Finding employers for hiring people who were already in the country was basically unheard of. But today, they're both happening. Maybe not the way everyone would like, but enough to encourage the president to push for another amnesty. Papadimitriou says the one big failure of the 86 bill was that it didn't allow for future legal immigration to meet workforce needs. He says that's why illegal immigration soared after 86, not because new migrants were hoping for another amnesty. Conservatives may not agree with that, but what they don't disagree with is that in 2013, the legal immigration system is just one more thing that needs fixing. For Latino USA, I'm Adrian Florido.
Coming up on Latino USA, the sons of Norteño giants dance to a different drummer. Musicians Raúl y Mexia tell us about their new record and about growing up with Los Tigres del Norte.
You know, Sundays in our house were like any Latino household. You know, you had the rancheras, Vicente Fernandez.
That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan for Los Tigueritos del Norte. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. When you pop in Arriba y Lejos, the debut album by the band Raúl y Mexaya, you're going to hear cumbia, hip-hop, and the unmistakable influence of norteño. That's because Raúl y Mexaya grew up hearing the kings of corridos, the famous Los Tigres del Norte, all the time. Why? Because Raúl y Mexaya, a.k.a. Raúl and Hernán Hernández, are the sons of Los Tigres del Norte bassist and singer Hernán Hernández. They're joining the family business and making music that speaks uniquely to their generation. Joining us from California are Raúl and Mexaya. Welcome to Latino USA, guys.
Thank you. Thank you, Maria.
All right. So Sundays for me, my dad would turn on, you know, Los Panchos, and it was like the calm day in the house with Los Panchos. What was a Sunday like in your house?
You know, Sundays in our house were, I think, like any Latino household on Sundays, you know, you had music playing. You had the rancheras, Vicente Fernandez, Ramon Ayala's, Los Cadetes de Linares. You know, my mom, she was born here in the States, so she would sometimes put on Michael Jackson, Marvin Gaye. So it was just a very eclectic taste of music in our house.
So when did you guys realize that your dad was a huge star and a Tigre del Norte?
In elementary school, I used to play on a soccer team, and it was made of predominantly Latino kids, and we were playing, and then this kid from the other team goes, "Do you know who that guy is?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's my dad." "That's your dad? My dad and my mom love your dad." This and then he stopped playing. So it was one of those experiences that you kind of like, not only does it hit an older generation, but it hits a younger generation of kids also. Yeah. And you just feel like, wow, this is a really big deal.
So let me ask you first, Los Tigres del Norte, where you come from as a family, very political. You decide to participate in an event called Todos Somos Arizona. It's basically an organization of individuals that were critical of Arizona's SB 1070.
Right.
So why did you guys decide to jump into the political fray right out of the gate?
Personally, I think we did it out of frustration. We've always kind of felt a sense of obligation to those type of situations and those type of things that happen in life, being that we are the sons of Los Tigres, and they don't consider themselves a political band, but they are for the people, they are for the community, and we've always considered ourselves that as well.
Well, actually, we have joining us by phone El Tigre Hernán Hernández. Let me ask you one particular question, Hernán, before we let you go. When you saw your sons becoming part of this movement, Todos Somos Arizona, taking, you know, their first stance politically on a national scale and musically, what went on for you?
When they were talking to me about Todos Somos Arizona, it made me really proud and happy, because I knew, you know, that they were following something that we've been doing for a long time. And for me, it was something that made me feel really good, because Los Tigres, you know, we've been thinking about our people, they stand up for the new generation of kids.
Hernán Hernández of Los Tigres del Norte, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
it's been great to speak with you.
I'm excited. I'm proud of you guys, and I love you. Like, you're still my little kid. I love you guys.
Bye. Bye. Love you, too.
Bye-bye.
So how hard was it as the sons of Los Tigres del Norte to find your own sound?
Raúl speaking. It was a challenge to find a distinct sound. Just in our tone of voice, you could already tell that we have that Hernández ting to our voices. And we shopped around quite a bit until we met Toy Selecta, who had a big influence on us and on this album. I think Toy is one of the only producers that was able to mesh both sides of West and East Coast. I mean, he's worked with Calle 13, and, you know, we've seen what a big impact they had on the West Coast and the East Coast. But we wanted to stay true to our roots also, you know what I mean? I think it's important to remember where we came from and remember our Mexican background.
I have to say that being on the East Coast, New Yorker that I am, when I listened to the album, the first song, Las Escondidas, I couldn't stop moving. It's definitely not, you know, norteño.
Totally. The music is just, it's very eclectic. I like to call it música campechana, you know? It's a little bit of everything. It's like a ceviche or a salsa, you know? It's, I think it really identifies with the Latino youth today that are born here in the States. You know, we don't just listen to norteño music. We don't just listen to, you know, hip hop.
I have to say, I loved Soul Mixa.
That song, yeah, is one of our favorites. And that was kind of a little ode to our grandfather, who is a mariachi. And so it was something that we felt, hey, let's add a little mariachi in there. Maybe people might like it. It gives it that soul feel.
Well, thanks so much for jumping in and creating music and doing something pretty wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. We appreciate it.
The members of the band Raul and Mexaya speaking to us from the studios at Stanford University.
Sea donde voy en donde quiero estar. El amor que tengo no te puedo dar. Nuestra relación ha llegado.
And now we have time for a bocadito, a little morsel of news that caught our eye this week, or actually our nose. It smelled like freshly cooked tamales, savory pork blending with sweet corn. But this aroma didn't come from the kitchen. A Chicago perfume maker created it along with a whole line of scented oils that smell like typical Latin foods. Zoraida Ortiz calls her line La 18 after 18th Street, the main road in the Mexican neighborhood of Pilsen where she lives. Besides tamales, Ortiz also makes oils that smell like horchata, a sweet rice drink, or pan de muerto, the sweet bread used during the Mexican Day of the Dead celebration. She also honors her own Puerto Rican heritage, with oils for lechon asado, roast pork, and the quenepa fruit. Ortiz sells her oils in a couple of shops on 18th Street in Chicago. Before she creates one, she closes her eyes and meditates on it. And then?
Essentially, it comes out of me as sort of the same way an artist would create a work of art on a canvas. My art specifically is inside of a bottle.
Some people might think it's odd to wear a perfume that smells like food, but Ortiz says the purpose isn't to make you hungry, but to make others hungry for you.
The idea behind it is for you to smell so good that someone, your object of desire, someone who you have a crush on will smell you and think of the kitchen and have their brain cells think of food and fall in love with you.
Ortiz donates part of her profits to a charity called Feeding America. Now that, you guessed it, makes sense. And for this week, that's Latino USA. If you have any comments or suggestions, go old school and dial 646-571-1228. That's 646-571-1228. Just tell us how to say your name clearly and where you're calling from. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Nadia Raymond, Andres Caballero, Lita Hartman, and Michael Jones. We have production help this week from Michael Simon Johnson and Neil Rausch at NPR New York. Our story on the 1986 immigration reform came from the Fronteras Desk, a public radio collaboration in the Southwest focusing on the border and immigration issues. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. Our program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is funded in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. PoetryFoundation.org. This is NPR.